Job 35, we have Elihu speaking, and we wondered, of course, the role of Elihu, and I have suggested that he functions as a sort of a literary device, or a device within the play, because it's a kind of a play for voices. And at this point, he's summarising, I think, the reasoning of the friends, because just listening to it, because people wouldn't have been reading it, they would have been hearing it, as I say, as a play for voices. They would have, the audience would have kind of forgotten the ins and outs of all the complex arguments. And so Elihu appears to sort of summarise it all. And yet he plays another role, I think, in that it's quite clear that the words and reasoning of the friends is of no value. Absolutely not. They're just convinced that Job must have sinned because he's suffering, and you suffer if you sin, and if you're righteous, you get blessed. And so they're saying, look, fess up, Job, and repent. You must have sinned. And Job's saying, look, I haven't sinned in the sense that you think I have. And they're therefore just coming out with traditional religion, as it were, and totally missing the far wider narrative of God's work amongst man. And so we're sort of hopeful. I think we're set up to hope that Elihu is the answer. He says, verse 4, I will answer you, Job, and your companions with you. We think, great, Elihu's going to add something new to the dialogue. And maybe now we're going to hear some sense. And yet, he actually only repeats what the friends have said, and as you see in this chapter, he states a lot of things about Job that are simply not true, and he cruelly misquotes some of the things that Job has said, and yet he says a few things that also are true. To say that Elihu was speaking on God's behalf is, I think, really not a complete picture, because he definitely does misquote Job and twist Job's words very, very badly. So out of this comes the glory of the fact that God, after Elihu, is going to appear and speak directly. So we're set up to all the more appreciate when God speaks. One of the themes in Job is that Job's disappointment in the traditional religion of his friends, his disappointment in his friends and their fellowship, his disillusion with, if you like, the church of his day, leads him to God. It leads him closer to God. And it's the same for us as the audience. We're not impressed with what the friends have said. We're looking for something better. Elihu arises and we're sitting on the edge of our seats, hopeful. He's so dogmatic, I'm going to now give the answer. And we're sitting on the edge of our seat, and then, well, he's just repeating the same old arguments of the friends, and he's clearly condemning Job when we've been told at the beginning of the book that Job is not a wicked man. He is upright and perfect before God, in God's own opinion. And that sets the parameters of the whole interpretation of Job. And yet Elihu fails clearly in keeping within those parameters. And this for us builds up the expectation and sort of relief when God himself finally speaks. And you can take a lesson from that, because it is out of disillusion with human wisdom, with human religious leadership, with human religion, even if it is the church, as it were, the people of God of your time, it is out of that that we come personally to God. It's why in some of the speeches of Job, he begins the speech by engaging with what the friends have said, and he's talking to the friends, and he's saying, look, no, what you're saying isn't right, I'm disappointed in your answers. And then sort of seamlessly almost, he merges into talking to God. And you start off reading, say, a chapter of one of Job's speeches, and you think, yeah, he's talking to the friends. And then you think, oh, wait a minute, now he's talking to God. And that very subtle changeover often doesn't have a specific point, like there is not a verse that says, and Job then pouted at his friends and said, not talking to you anymore. And he got on his knees, put his hands together, and started praying to God. No, there isn't such a verse. It's a more subtle change, that he's talking to the friends, and then you realize, as you read those verses further, he's talking to God now. And this is how it is, that your disillusion with your, as it were, religion and the religious side of things, and the failure of people to really give the answers, leads you to God, or it should do. It leads you to personal connection with Him and personal engagement with Him. This is one reason why God allows religion to go wrong. And it's why in the lives of many mature believers who I know, at some point in their lives, their religion went wrong. Their religious experience went on a nosedive. And they became disillusioned with maybe their denomination, the structure, the religious structures around them. Not necessarily leaving it, but all the same, they came to see that the whole thing had feet of clay. Now, some people who identify God with their particular church, well, if things go wrong with the church, they lose their faith in God, but then perhaps they never really believe in God anyway. Whereas I think the more healthy and hopeful approach is that, okay, so you lose your faith in people, but then you come to believe the more strongly in God. You engage with Him. And this is what you see with Job. And as I say, the whole role of Elihu, I think, is to just point that up a bit, that everyone's sort of hopeful that he's going to be the answer, and he also is not the answer. Well, he says, verse 6, if you have sinned, this is Job, what effect do you have on God? If your transgressions are multiplied, well, what are you doing to him? In other words, he's so high above you, Job, that what's all your issue about sin or righteousness? He doesn't care anyway. He's not hurt by your sin. And then he says, verse 7, and if you're righteous, what do you give him? What does he receive from your hand? And he's saying, you know, you think you're far too important, Job. You think that sin is somehow hurting God and diminishing God, and you think that your righteousness is adding to him. This is really postmodernist thinking, really, whereby everything is sort of pretty on a level, and don't get too excited about anything. And if that is a God, well, he sort of wouldn't be too offended at whatever you do, and he wouldn't be too happy either, whatever you do. He is distant and on his own agenda. No, what Elihu says here is seriously wrong. The whole point is that God is so sensitive to human behavior. If you sin, Elihu says, what effect do you have on him? If your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? What do you do to him? You rob him of his glory. God himself is presented as being at stake when he says later on that he is married to Israel and they have disgraced him in the eyes of the nations, that they acted the prostitute when they were married to God. And he says, I am broken by your adulterous heart. God was broken by their adulterous heart. But Elihu's saying, oh, look, God's far above all that. And in a way, hardline religion leads you to that, the idea that, oh, wretched little man that we are, that I am, that we are here on this planet, and God is so much greater. Well, yeah, if you take that too far, you end up saying that, well, sure, like Elihu says, well, so what? Sin doesn't particularly hurt him, righteousness does not add to him. But that is not the case. Of course, God is far above man, so it is. But he is far above us in the sense that he has this amazing humility and this amazing condescension and ability to, as it were, come down to us so that he, Almighty God, is hurt and yet made to rejoice by our behavior. This is the wonderful truth. This is why there's some amazing passages in the prophets. God says, for example, in Jeremiah, I had hoped that you would be my sons of whom I would be proud, but I am not. You have disgraced me. All his hopes were set on them. And the Lord, again, in the parables, brings this out, that he sends his servants, the prophets, to the vineyard to get the fruit, and they beat one and stone another, and then he says, well, I'll send my son. Surely they will reverence my son, and they don't, and we feel his pain and his hurt. And so Elihu's argument, as I say, is not right here. And he pretty much condemns Job when he sort of says in verses 12 and 13 that, well, the wicked cry, but it's an empty cry, and therefore the Almighty doesn't regard it. And, well, that's he's commenting on Job's complaint that God doesn't seem to hear his prayers. And he's saying, yeah, well, it's just an empty cry, so God doesn't pay any attention to that. You notice he calls God the Almighty. Well, of course God is the Almighty, but I think he's taken the sense of almightiness in a wrong way. He's got this idea that God is so great and mighty that you cannot touch him, that you cannot touch his heart. And yet, the whole message of the gospel, and in fact the message of the prophets, is that you can touch the heart of God, that you can rejoice the heart of God. In Hosea, God says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I reject you? My repentings, my changes of mind are kindled together within me. Incredible language, and you meet this very often. And the wonder of it all is that we can touch God's heart, and he is as the father of the two sons who rejoices when the prodigal returns and throws the party. He is as the woman looking for her lost coin and finding it, the shepherd seeking the lost and finding it, absolutely thrilled that a guy standing at the number 5 tram stop bowed his head and repented and asked God to truly forgive him and have him back for something that he remembered doing in the past or 5 minutes ago or yesterday or whenever. This is the God whom we have to do with. It is not so, what Elihu says, that God is so far away, that so almighty, that we can touch him in terms of his emotions. No, absolutely not. And when God reveals himself to Job in all his glory, then we start to see that this is finally the God who does feel, the God who is sensitive in a way far beyond even our understanding of what it is to be sensitive.